Welcome back to another week of Behind the Lens. I'm Debbie Elias, film critic, creator, and host of Behind the Lens, where we go behind the lens and below the line with all those movers and shakers, those film and TV and streaming makers, the producers, directors, writers, actors, cinematographers, makeup artisans, production designers, costume designers, film editors, sound editors, mixers and designers, VFX gurus, composers, stuntmen and women, and so many more. And you all know I like to talk, and I love to talk about movies and film. So it is a joy to be with you every week to give you a front seat. You know, the making of the sausage with the who, what, where, when, why, and how of movie making with these interviews. Now, I know I debated last week whether I'd do a show for this extended 4th of July weekend, and I decided I've got so many interviews to get to you that in addition to a bonus interview last week, yes, definitely an interview today for you. So, and it is another entertaining and enlightening episode and interview, thanks to writer-director Anthony Frith and his documentary Mockbuster. I love this documentary. It is so much fun, and I'm going to explain why it's so much fun. Mockbuster isn't your typical documentary. This is a documentary directed by Anthony Frith, an Australian filmmaker. Let's just get that out there, because Australia, I've had more fun the past few years talking to Australian filmmakers. I've always loved the work and the creativity that comes out of Australia. And Anthony is now another filmmaker that I'm adding to my cadre of filmmakers from down under. He's just wonderful. When you hear him, he's so fun. He's so engaging. He's so sweet. But I digress. Mockbuster, it's not your typical doc. This is a documentary directed by Anthony concurrently with his directing of yet another Asylum B-movie classic, this one, The Land That Time Forgot. Now, I know you know the Asylum and their films. This is the studio responsible for the Sharknado franchise and a few hundred other glorious B-movie genre gems that inevitably revolve around sharks, aliens, dinosaurs, Nazis, Russians, nukes, bad accents, vampires, zombies, and are generally a takeoff on known blockbusters or titles, even books, book titles, by altering titles and scripts ever so slightly into what have become known as mockbusters. Now, don't ever knock The Asylum and its founders, creators, David Ramawi and Paul Bales. These guys, much as what Jason Blum did, he came up with a great business model and formula for horror with his founding of Blumhouse. And we all know how Blumhouse has just exploded. Well, The Asylum, they have their own business model and formula for movie making that lets them churn out films, many in less than a week, with principal photography. 6 days of principal photography for a lot of these films. That's it. That's all a director gets. And then they do all the post-production in a well-oiled in-house machine and then bring them straight to you on digital video, DVD, aka direct-to-video platform. And their films are, on the whole, a ton of fun and quite often have some pretty good production values. Some of the performances, that's another thing. But if you see an Asylum film that has Michael Paré or Eric Roberts in it, oh, grab that sucker and watch it. I think they're like the go-to guys, especially Michael Paré. And of course, I'll see him in anything. Even a lot of his roles are similar. He's always solid. He's always fun. And I just think he's fantastic. And I love seeing him pop up in so many films from The Asylum. So enter, we have this, you know, Asylum has this plan in place. So you got to wonder, where do they get their filmmakers? You know, who wants to do... Now, granted, you're not always going to have a Sharknado. You're not always going to have a massive blockbuster hit like Sharknado and the Sharknado franchise. But where do you get directors who are willing to come in with 6 days to film, not having a script, and other parameters and requirements, mandates, that the two Davids and Paul have at the Asylum? Enter Australian filmmaker Anthony Frith. Now, Anthony has a really interesting background, but he's primarily made a living making corporate video shorts and PSAs, like a How to Grieve video manual. Seriously. But he has long dreamed of directing a feature film. And one day, light bulb went off and he got the idea to reach out to the Asylum asking to direct a film. As luck would have it, the Asylum had a movie for him to direct, The Land That Time Forgot. Terrific. But again, Anthony has to adhere to the Asylum model. 6 days to film, no script, and they wanted it shot in Australia. Okay, he's in Australia. He lives in Australia. Not a problem. Until he has to find his own cast and crew in Australia. And finding at least one big name to do a film that is this low budget is really tough. But Anthony took things a step farther. He saw the comedic potential in documenting the process of making a film for The Asylum. And he spoke with David Latt, the CEO and head of production at The Asylum, and pitched his idea to shoot a documentary of the making of The Land That Time Forgot. While he was shooting The Land That Time Forgot. I mean, so often you see making of documentaries about, or shorts, or DVD extras, but they're done after. Long after, sometimes years after, a film is done and somebody gets the idea, ooh, maybe we should go back and get interviews now and, you know, maybe we could put together a making of. Well, Anthony's idea is, let's do it at the same time. And Latt said, go for it. He loved the idea. But this also meant Anthony would be directing two films simultaneously, a documentary and a narrative, with the documentary capturing the entire Asylum process of B-movie filmmaking. Thus, Mockbuster was born. And as I said, Mockbuster is a scream. I absolutely loved it. The chaos, you've got to see it to believe it. It's great. And this conversation with Anthony is almost too much fun as we dive into the logistics and challenges of directing two films concurrently. The Land That Time Forgot was financed entirely by the Asylum, while it was left to Anthony and his documentary producers to find financing for Mockbuster. And as you will hear, Anthony makes it very clear and stresses this, that the two productions maintained separate budgets, did not overlap financially. That was one of my big questions. Was Asylum also going to be funding the documentary? Were you trading crews back and forth? No. The only intersection was Anthony, which is real, makes it even more interesting. And, you know, as we dive even deeper, Anthony goes into detail about the intense pre-production and scheduling required to manage both projects, because you are shooting both at the same time, at the same minute, at the same hour, on the same day. Especially during that six-day principal photography window for The Land That Time Forgot. And that six-day shoot was a key element of Anthony's approach to Mockbuster, as everything about the doc relied upon the timetable for The Land That Time Forgot. Now, working with his cinematographer, Max Corkindale, they meticulously planned the documentary's aesthetic and coverage. Often, you know, and it was based upon whatever was happening with the feature film that day. And they often coordinated via in-ear monitors to capture key moments without disrupting the feature film production. The documentary crew blended into the background, and thus allowing the feature film's cast and crew to focus on their work while still being observed for the documentary. This is trickier than you may think, logistically. The post-production processes for the two films were also distinct, and I found this really fascinating. And Anthony goes into a lot of detail about this. Asylum handled all the editing and post for their feature in-house, with Anthony providing minimal input. I mean, they even did pickup shots and added scenes and tossed in Michael Paré for a scene, which Anthony was, I think, confused by when they were filming it because it kind of didn't really fit, or maybe it fit, but it was totally out of the blue from what he had shot and where he thought the film was going. But something that I really love that Anthony and his editor, David Scarborough, made sure to include in Mockbuster are scenes showcasing the legendary Asylum VFX supervisor, Glenn Campbell, who passed away in November of 2024. Glenn's work it's legendary. His visual effects, his insight, and there's some really beautiful scenes in Mockbuster where he's explaining certain things that Anthony has to consider in terms of filming, as to where he's got to place visual effects. Where does that dinosaur have to go? Which means you've got to block this out to give him room to insert. So there's a lot of really instructional filmmaking happening here. With the underlying film that we're getting the benefit of seeing explained through the documentary. Now, in contrast, Anthony was deeply involved in editing Mockbuster alongside his editor, David Scarborough. They had a very strong creative rapport and did not have time constraints like those of the Asylum for the feature film. You know, Asylum wants to get the film out there. You make the film, you get it done, you get it out there, you recoup your money, and you put that money towards the next film, and you just keep going. It's very cyclical. It works beautifully. But David and Anthony didn't have the time constraints, and that allowed that the Asylum had on the land that time forgot. And since Anthony wasn't really involved in the editing, that freed him up so he and David could just focus on Mockbuster. And it allowed them to take their time in editing. They also got to take their time because they didn't have a finished anything from The Land That Time Forgot because of pickups that were still being done and all the post and scoring and everything on that end. But I have to say, David does a knockout job with the editing on Mockbuster. He strikes a balance between the behind-the-scenes on the doc and the in-camera processes of the Asylum feature. And they really work together to shape the documentary's narrative and comedic tone, even as they waited for the feature's ending to be completed. Because there is a great segment. And it's no real spoiler, but there is a great segment that shows the cast and crew, the crew and Anthony, and their family and friends for Mockbuster. It does show them sitting in a theater and watching completed things. We don't see the completed things, but, you know, you kind of needed that. Wait for that to finish Mockbuster. But they did a wonderful job on the edit of Mockbuster. And, you know, composer Bryony Marks, she apparently, according to, as you'll hear Anthony talk about, she joined Mockbuster late in the process. But she did a very quick turnaround delivering a full score. And it truly captures the fun of Mockbuster. It's really interesting as we go back and forth between Mockbuster and The Land That Time Forgot, almost like Anthony jockeyed back and forth in his mind during production. this whole conversation, the interview, is filled with practical production details, fun anecdotes about doing double duty at the same time, as well as the unique challenges of directing two films in different genres simultaneously. And it's also refreshing to hear Anthony's praise for the Mockbuster producers and crew. And of course, the folks at The Asylum, especially line producer Brendan Patrizzo, who The Asylum sent down to Australia to help him with The Land That Time Forgot. And I got to tell you, watching Brendan, he worked mathematical monetary miracles to pull off The Land That Time Forgot. I want him to give me a math class in how he does computation. Let me tell you. Brendan is actually one of the fun parts, the Mockbuster crew captures, Max cinematographer captures a lot of footage of Brendan as he's trying to logistically navigate things to complete The Land That Time Forgot within 6 days. And yes, Anthony does reflect on the steep learning curve of making a feature-length film and the adaptability required to manage unforeseen changes during production. So there's a lot of cool stuff that comes out in this interview. So I hope you enjoy it. And, you know, filmmakers, especially some new filmmakers out there, you know, take heed. Theo Taplitz, I'm talking to you, my friend, who's now working on his film. He's graduated film school. He's my favorite future filmmaker from years ago at LA Film Festival. And Theo, I'm so happy to say, is working on a new film now that I can't wait to see now that he's graduated and he's on his own. So filmmakers like Theo and even the rest of you, I think you'll pick up some gems, some kernels in this interview. So take a listen as writer-director Anthony Frith talks all things Mockbuster. I didn't know what to expect with this, with Mockbuster. Number one, I love Asylum films.
Good. Yeah, same.
I always have. I love them. And I have seen, I'd say probably about 200 of them. If not more.
That's impressive.
I love their business model. And their films are the kind of films that you want to see at 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning when you're just kicking back. You don't want to have to think. You just want something stupid on the screen in front of you. And you can never go wrong with sharks, dinosaurs, aliens, getting lost in space somewhere, falling over cliffs, tidal waves, nuclear explosions.
Yeah.
Or Michael Paré, who has been in, I think, most of their films.
I think so.
So, this just, you know, the whole idea just tickled me to no end. And then to see what you've got going here with Mockbuster, where you've got two films essentially going. You're shooting the film within the film.
Yeah.
And it is hilarious. Where did you even start with this idea of doing the documentary? I mean, yeah, I get the whole premise of how you ended up at Asylum. And the hilarity of David and Paul, and their interviews are just to die for. But the whole idea of making a documentary about making a film in 6 days for Asylum, where did that idea, when did that fit into this puzzle?
Yeah. So I was kind of like, it kind of came at the same time, really. Like, I just was kind of like, oh, it'd be funny to make an Asylum film. And then, I see myself as a documentary filmmaker, usually, so I'm always kind of looking for those stories.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I kind of thought of, like, making an Asylum film, it kind of immediately came. I was like, oh, no, I should make, like, a film about me making a film for The Asylum. That would be funny. And then, yeah, kind of just reached out to The Asylum with that, and they jumped on board pretty quickly. So, yeah, it was kind of like the same idea.
Now, what were the thoughts? Did you present this to David and Paul from Asylum? and say, hey, guys, what do you think if we do this?
Pretty much. I emailed David Latt and was like, you know, I've got an idea. Like, I'd love to chat with you. And he's like, yeah, sure. Let's, like, book a Zoom. And then we called and just, like, chatted for a couple minutes about, like, you know, anything. And then he's like, all right, what's your idea? And I was like, I want to make one of your films and then make a documentary about it. And he's like, yeah, sure, let's do it. It was just, like, an immediate acceptance. And, yeah, he was very, like, enthusiastic about it from the get-go.
So then from a directorial standpoint and a producing standpoint and a creativity standpoint, because your hands are locked to a large degree for The Land That Time Forgot, because the asylum has their rules, they have their business model, and this is what they want, X, Y, Z.
Yeah.
So it kind of stifles your individuality and creativity. But in making the documentary of making The Land That Time Forgot, did you have free rein with that kind of construction, though, as to what you wanted to film and what you wanted to do? Or did they try and govern that as well?
No, they were pretty open. They were pretty, like, as you can see in the doco, they're pretty, like, they wear their hearts on their sleeves. So that they... You know, they gave us, like, full access to them, their building, their library, like, kind of everything. They were on board for it. They were super supportive about the documentary. So, yeah, no real issues there.
How did you break out the budgetary constraints? You've got two films here essentially being piggybacked on top of each other concurrently. Obviously, shooting the documentary costs money, in addition to The Land That Time Forgot that had no real money. But thanks to Brendan's monetary creativity, I don't know how he does his math, but I really want to take a math course from that man. The way he does financing, we could all survive quite well on making no money.
Great.
But I'm curious, how did that impact you as to what you could spend for the documentary? Or was that cost so minimal that your credit card could absorb it?
So we had two, so the two productions were treated completely separately. So the Asylum film, Land of Time Forgot, was completely financed by the Asylum.
Right.
And then the documentary was financed by, we had some distributors, private investment. In Australia, we've got, like, incentives to make films here as well, and some grants. So it was financed by, like, partly by the government, film festivals. That was completely, entirely its own budget, and they didn't cross over at all. They didn't really butt heads in that way.
Now, did you have to go find these investors for the documentary?
I didn't personally. The producers did, luckily. we kind of came up with a pitch, like a pitch document and a trailer, just to kind of show people and see if they were interested. And then the government money is like a very formal sort of grant application online that you just fill out and send to them, and they, you know, have a panel of people that view it and decide which films are worthy of the financing here.
Well, anything that goes and shoots in Australia, that should make it worthy right there, because I've never seen a film that looked bad that came out of Australia.
We make good movies here.
Australia makes very good movies, Anthony.
Yeah.
I love...
I don't want to brag, but...
No, it's very, very true. And some very incredibly talented filmmakers come out of Australia. And not just doing horror films, but doing, you know, great thrillers and things like that. But now, did you have trouble getting people to come on board, producers to come on board, to then go champion money for you to make the documentary?
Not really. So, So there's three producers, Sandy, Naomi, and David. Sandy and I have been friends for a long time, and we're very on the same page with what we find funny. So he kind of like, yes, immediately, let's do this. This is amazing. Although he didn't believe me when I told him that Lat said he would let us do the movie, and he called him the next day just to make sure I wasn't losing my mind. And then I met David and Naomi at a conference. So we have it's called AIDC here, like the International Documentary Conference. It's once a year.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there, and I met David. And then years later, I think it was, I can't remember what year it was, but I was heading to, he lives in Melbourne, I live in Adelaide. I was heading to Melbourne, I just messaged him, like, hey, like, we could catch up. So we just caught up for some dinner, and we were just talking about what we were sort of working on. And I mentioned Mockbuster to him, and he's like, oh, this is amazing, let's do it. But he had experience making a similar documentary where he tried to become a celebrity in Japan, called Big in Japan. Yeah, it's very, like, shares a lot of that DNA, that sort of host-led underdog stuff. So he's got a comedy documentary kick as well. And then Naomi was the same as David, really. Just thought it was a funny premise, and that they worked together, David and Naomi, and then jumped on board too. So that wasn't difficult at all, really. We all kind of just thought it was a funny, silly idea, and were interested in pursuing it.
For you as a director, because you're directing Mockbuster, you are directing The Lamb That Time Forgot. How do you divvy up? Obviously, there is pre-production involved with both. And because of the speed at which The Land That Time Forgot is being shot, you've got to shoot your doc in that same amount of time.
Yes.
How do you logistically plan? Every director out there right now is going to want to know, how do you do pre-pro on two films running on the same schedule at the same time?
Yeah, it was tricky, and a stupid thing to do with my life, but in retrospect, I'm glad I did it. So the documentary had kind of a bit of a longer tail, so there was about a month or so before we started shooting Land That Time Forgot that we're actually shooting the documentary, where we, headed over to LA, shot some of the backstory stuff. So we kind of, like, got into a rhythm shooting the documentary over that period, whereas the Land That Time Forgot had, like, sort of 4 days of pre-pro and then you're in. The tricky part was when the two productions crossed over, so the 6 day shoot and the documentary were shooting concurrently.
Mm-hmm.
So it took lots of planning. So Max, the DOP, and I, we had I kind of built a PowerPoint of like the aesthetics of the film, how I thought it should look, how I thought it should be shot. And then Max and I kind of went through that and ripped that apart a few times and worked out what the aesthetic was, which we kind of toyed with during that initial sort of shoot of Mockbuster, and kind of, had that set in stone. So by the time we got to the shoot, we knew what this film looked like at the very least. But once we got to set, it was Max and I calling every morning to discuss what was being shot that day. So we had the schedule, like, from the AD about what scenes were being shot, and we kind of worked out what the scenes that could be either funny or problematic or juxtapose well with what happened the previous day.
Mm-hmm.
So each day would call and be like, oh, yesterday this happened, so this scene, that might pay off. So let's make sure we film this. So we had those sort of conversations every day. I was also mic'd up, and Travis, the sound recordist, had this idea of giving all the crew of the documentary in-ear monitors so I could actually communicate with them.
Mm-hmm.
So if I was about to go do something or talk to someone, I could just whisper, like, hey, Max, I'm, like, going to go talk to Aaron about this. Like, we should go film that. And then him and Brad, the B-cam operator, what did you call it in football, where you kind of get into positions? Like,
offsides.
Game plan sort of things.
Offsides.
Yeah. Yeah, and they would kind of, like, work out their little maneuvers and how to shoot it. So they had their, like, internal game plan because they could communicate too. So they would know how to get into position to shoot the scene that was about to happen. So it was lots of that sort of sneaky stuff. And there'd also be moments where we would be like, oh, like, everyone, Land of Time Forgot crew, stop. We need to get the shot for the documentary. And the crew hated that. But, there were some shots in the film that we just needed to get just because, for moments of reflection or comedy or whatever. It was a kind of a mix of... We tried not to interfere with the production too much because we thought that The Land That Time Forgot should have been like an all-consuming sort of event in the film where everyone's like in on that and the documentary is almost forgotten about.
Mm-hmm.
So we can just kind of observe that. And I guess it was tricky for me because I was in between the two things. But the good thing for the crew is that the Land That Time Forgot crew, so it's so tricky talking about two films at once. You kind of say the crew. The Land That Time Forgot crew kind of forgot they were being filmed because the documentary crew kind of got lost in the midst of them.
Mm-hmm.
And because there were so many cameras and people floating around, but no one knew when or where they were being filmed, which was kind of funny. But yeah, lots of pre-planning, lots of discussions, lots of whispering into a hot radio mic. I would try to have lunch with the Land of Time Forgot crew as much as possible, but would inevitably be talking to Max and the producers about like what we should be shooting next during the breaks. So I didn't really get much downtime during the shoot. But yeah, it was tricky. It was tricky. And there would be moments where Max would just have to kind of, you know, if I was in on a scene and talking to an actor for a long time, he would have to like be on his own and kind of work out what to shoot. But like, he had a fair... Max and I had worked together before, so he knows what I kind of like and what I find funny too.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got a very similar sense of humor. So it all kind of worked out when he would shoot things knowing that I would think it's funny or interesting. So yeah, it was tricky. It was honestly the stupidest thing I've ever done with my life. And
yeah.
I wouldn't recommend it.
But Anthony, it's the kind of thing that is so damn stupid that you just know you're going to do it again. At some point.
I would, in a heartbeat.
See? You know, that's... Everybody has those things that they do, and you know, it is the stupidest thing on the planet, and I might die doing this, and then you're done, and it's like, okay, I lived. All right.
Yeah.
It might be 10 years down the road, but you'll do it again. I have no doubt, Anthony, you will do this again. Now...
Let's hope so.
It's all great and good while you're filming, and you've got your 6 days of shooting, and let's not forget your weekend thrown in there while you're watering your lawn. That was very exciting. I just want you to know I appreciated that. You didn't neglect your homeownership duties. But then you've got to worry about post-production. The Asylum has their whole post-production stuff built up beautifully in-house.
Yeah, yep.
Not the least of which was Glenn. Glenn's passage, it was really sad for the industry.
Yeah, it was.
Because...
Yeah, he was a legend.
And his work was always so damn good. Always had been.
Yeah.
So, I'm so sad. I'm so upset when Glenn passed. I was very upset about that in real life. So, to see you acknowledge... He's being acknowledged in the credits on this film is great. And well-deserved. But,
yeah.
You know, the Asylum has all this post. Everything is in place. They've got their editing, their editing suites. That's all put together. Their VFX, their sound. Everything is in place. But then you've got to get all of this stuff for your sound, for your editing, and for your score for the documentary. You got to pull all that off on your end. So that now, were you running post-production on both films at the same time? Or did you just have to worry about yours? Because watching the Mockbuster, it looks like because of the reshoots and the changes that the Asylum wanted. And of course, so Michael could get another film credit on his resume and wearing a uniform, no less. So it's like they had their own idea of how to change the script of how to buttress what they had you shoot in your 6 days, which kind of makes me think that they already had their own editing plans in place and you were not part of the editing process. So therefore you could really focus on the editing of the documentary versus the Land of Time Forgot. Is that correct?
Yeah. That's pretty much on point. Yeah. So the Asylum kind of, They kind of run posts themselves, so you're kind of hired to oversee set. I did get a couple of random notes on the edit, but at the end of the day, it was up to the two Davids and Paul to decide what the film should be. But what is wild to me is if you think filming the movie in 6 days is crazy, I can't remember the days exactly. I think we finished shooting on a Monday or a Tuesday or something. By the Thursday, I had an entire cut of the film. In my inbox, which was wild. So, yeah, they work quick. They know what they're doing. I guess after you make 350 films, I feel like you can feel pretty confident in what you're doing.
You know, they've got it down to a science. They really
they
do.
They really do. Yeah, it's really admirable, I think.
So now, while they've got they're working on the editing, and you're not sitting there with the editor in the editing bay and looking over shot for shot, you got to do that with Mockbuster.
That's so right. Yeah.
How was your timing and working with your editor, David Scarborough? Because I have to say, I'm very impressed with David's editing of Mockbuster, of the documentary, and how he really shows the process of making the film but also giving us enough elements of the film, The Land That Time Forgot, so we are totally in the loop and understand at all times what's going on with the Land That Time Forgot. David did a wonderful job on the doc.
I agree. Yeah, he's incredible. He's, I've worked with him before too. So him, Max, and I have all worked together once, which was, we just kind of really clicked in a lot of ways, which was good. But yeah, Dave is an incredible editor, I think. He's cut lots of films down here, and they've all gone on to win awards and screen all over the world, and he's very skilled. He's got a very comedic sensibility, very good comedic sensibility, but also like very sympathetic and empathetic sort of person too, so he knows how to wring those sort of nice character moments out as well. And his pacing is great. I think his, like, the way he paces his cuts is really, you know, it there's like ebbs and flows, but they continuously move in a nice way, I think. I think he's very clever.
Yeah, his pacing on Mockbuster is terrific. Did you actually get to sit in the editing bay with David to work on the edit of Mockbuster?
Yeah, we did. Editing is my favorite part of the whole post-production. I love post-production.
Well, that's where that's your last shot to tell the story that you want to tell.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and it's just fun too. Like Dave and I, we get along. So we're just like piercing ourselves laughing the whole like edit, just trying to find all the funny moments and, you know, massage them in. It's just so much fun. I was there for most of the edit. There's a couple of days where Dave just needed to, like, you know, he wanted his time to kind of sit with it a bit and stuff like that. So I was probably in for 3 or 4 days a week for the duration. I can't remember how many weeks yet it was. It was a couple of months.
Wow.
Editing. So we had like a lot more time to sit with Mockbuster than we did Land.
No, really?
But what was kind of funny is we didn't have an ending because we hadn't shot it yet. So we were kind of editing to nothing for a point. I think, I can't remember exactly when Dave started editing. It might have been just before I went to back to LA or just after I went back to LA.
Mm-hmm.
So we were kind of working to nothing because we hadn't even shot without spoiling anything, the sort of ending scene. We hadn't shot that yet because we didn't have the film. So we were kind of trying to piece together a film without knowing how it ultimately resolved, which is kind of interesting. But we had a lot more time to kind of play with ideas. We had more time than the Land of Time Forgot, but in the grand scheme of things, I don't think we had that much time for a documentary, especially considering how much footage we shot. It was fun at the very least.
Did you get to have discussions with your composer, with Brian E. Marks, for what music you wanted for Mockbuster? Obviously, because we're not seeing and hearing the finished product of The Land That Time Forgot, so we have no clue unless we've seen the film as to the score that's there. But generally, as with asylum films, most of it sounds pretty much the same. But you got the opportunity here. Number one, you get to sit with your editor for a feature-length doc. Now you've got to work with your composer for what you wanted musically. And here again, because you don't know how the underlying project is going to finish, how do you work with your composer to have him come up with something that is musically complete for, you know, what you're telling with Mockbuster?
Yeah. I think Bryony came on quite, like, near the end. So we had, I think by the time she came on board, we had everything kind of in place. So, like, a full rough cut at the very least that she could see. And, she kind of saw the full picture at least. And she is, the speed at which she writes music is so crazy. I think she had a draft score for the entire film within like a week or something. I just couldn't believe how quickly she wrote that music and how good it is too. It's one of my favorite parts of the whole film, her music. I think it's so great. Just one of those sort of talents that can just pull things out of thin air and make a complete thing pretty quickly. She's from Melbourne as well. So, again, I'm from Adelaide. So we kind of had a few phone calls and Zoom chats and stuff, but I wasn't sitting with her as she was like writing music. We had some iterations of drafts where I'd give notes and she would come up with new ideas until finally recording once the film was locked, which she did in a day. She recorded the whole score with a full band, opera singer, horn player, harp player in a day.
Oh, my God.
It was like 45 keys or something.
Oh, my God.
She's incredible. She is absolutely incredible musician.
Wow. See, now you got to be careful because you get somebody as talented as David for your editor, as talented as Bryony. You've now exposed them to the asylum. The Davids and Paul could try and steal them away for themselves now. Yeah. So when you make your next film, you can't get them.
Yeah, that's true. My next asylum film, I could, though.
Well, yeah. So will you do another asylum film? Are they happy enough that they want you to do another one?
They've asked. They actually loved The Land of Time for God. They were really proud of it. And they've asked me a few times if I want to. I haven't said yes yet. But the door's still open.
Well, so, Anthony, don't be stupid. Tell them yes. You do want to do... You want to direct another film. You now have made it through the process. You know what they expect. You know how to do it. You can shoot a film in 6 days. You've proven that. And come on, how can you not want to direct more films that have dinosaurs, Russians, Australians, Germans... Some with good accents, some with bad accents,
yeah.
But explosions, aliens. You got to do one with aliens. And I still think there's always room for more sharks, especially from an Australian
exactly.
filmmaker.
That's what I think.
Aussie filmmaker, sharks. How about shooting an asylum film in Australia about sharks?
It's a match made in heaven, really.
Sharks and Nazis. How about that? You know,
like a spin-off of The Land That Time Forgot with
yes,
was it Frederick von Schoen? Yeah, that'd be,
yes,
I'd pay to see that.
Yes. So now, at the end of the day, you've seen how a feature film is done, even though in the post process and all, you didn't get to be as hands-on as you would in a regular production situation. And you've made it through beginning to end everything with the documentary. So you've now completed two features, a doc and a narrative. What did you learn about yourself besides the fact you need to see a psychiatrist before you undertake something like this again? What did you learn about yourself as a filmmaker having gone through these two different disciplines of filmmaking?
Yes. It's so crazy when you put it like that. I think the big thing for me was that, like, it's hard to know how to make a film until you've made one, which sounds crazy, but, like, until I finished The Land That Time Forgot, I didn't realize I actually didn't know what goes into making a 90-minute film. Because you go to film school and you're making, like, 5 to 6 minute things.
Yeah.
And then you leave film school, you're making 6 to 8 minute things. And, like, that's its own skill, right? Like, that's a completely separate skill from making a 90-minute feature film, I think. They're two different forms in my head completely. Learning how to make a 90-minute film that's functional and at the bare least watchable is, you know, what I feel like I learned a bit about. Also, just like working under that extreme pressure and on the fly, like with both films, like documentary in particular, but also with The Asylum, it's like things happen and things change so rapidly that you're always thinking ahead as much as possible. And those, you know, those plans you've made and never really come into fruition because something else happens. So it's a matter of just, like, yeah, really thinking on your feet. And I guess my experience is quite unique because I was doing two different genres at the same time. So I was thinking on my feet in two different, completely different ways. But, yeah, that, I think that's the kind of a skill that you can only really learn in that situation, like in the deep end. Yeah, that'd probably be my two big takeaways.
Now, I do have a really weird question for you about... Mm-hmm. I love the footage where everybody's sitting there doing a table read.
Yeah.
Nobody has a printed script in front of them. They're all looking at tablets, their cell phone. Does the asylum not spring? Don't they pay for the paper to photocopy scripts for everybody? That is a burning question.
It might have been in the budget, but... yeah, I can't remember the conversations on that, to be honest.
Well, Brandon might have cut that out of your budget.
Yeah, we had scripts on set for, like, one day, and then for the rest of the shoot, I had to, like, look at the script on my phone. So I think the first day I got an actual script, and then I was just expecting them every other day, but then I didn't. So, I've got the same question as you, is what I'm getting at.
Well, obviously, somebody cut the paper budget. Clearly, yeah. The paper and ink budget has been cut somewhere along. Now, did you have scripts for your documentary? Were you at least kind enough to have shot listing and things printed out for your people, for your crew?
No, they just had the schedule for the Land That Time Forgot, and we kind of used that as the guide for the documentary.
Was it printed on paper?
It might have been. I actually can't remember. That's a good...
You know, because... Bear this in mind, Anthony. For your future projects, always make sure you have those things printed on paper. Because when there is satellite interference in the sky, or somebody severs the underground cable lines, nobody will be able to access anything on their phone or a tablet.
True.
But you can always hold that paper in your hand. And it works really well when you're mad at somebody and you just want to shake your fist holding it in their face. So, yeah. Just a helpful thought there.
Yeah.
But
in case the apocalypse comes, we can still finish the film.
See? Thinking ahead. Thinking ahead there. I know when people watch Mockbuster, and they're going to see you down in the basement with all the boxes and boxes and boxes of the Asylum, you know, DVDs. Did they let you have one of everything for your own personal library?
Oh, pretty much, yeah. I've got a couple of dozen at home. They were very generous. It's like the Criterion closet. I just got to go through and pick my favorites, which was nice.
Okay, now I'm disappointed in you, Anthony. They've made over 300 films, and you only have a couple dozen.
I only had so much bag space.
Ship them to yourself. Don't pack them, ship them to yourself. Oh, Anthony, what are we going to do with you? You only get 6 days to shoot. You at least need a really good perk. a free product. Now, have you had to go back to making bereavement guide videos or some of the really hilarious early short videos that you and your friends made? I love seeing those at the opening of the film. It tells us right there how creative you are and can be when you are allowed to be. But have you had to go back to any of that? Or between
I'm just editing now, which is good. So just editing reels, social reels for an array of clients. It's all right. I can work from home. You know, it's not too bad.
Well,
there's no money in documentary filmmaking, apparently, so...
So just go make another film for The Asylum. It only takes 6 days to shoot. So you could be home after 6 days. You've got to direct another feature. You've got to direct another documentary, Anthony. The fact that you could pull both of these off is just mind-blowing and mind-boggling. And Werner Herzog couldn't have done it. I guarantee you, you really outdid yourself here in pulling this off. And the whole idea of doing the documentary about this insane process. The insane but profitable process that the asylum has. An entertaining process. This is just the very fact you came up with the idea for the documentary tells me you got to exert your creativity. Don't ever think that you didn't, you know, regret you didn't get to be totally creative, you didn't get to do this or you didn't get to do that with the film that was following these very stringent guidelines that the Davids and Paul have at the asylum. Because you really got to show us your creativity.
Thank you.
With Mockbuster, which means you've got to go back to work. I'm sorry. That's you know, the bottom line.
Yeah, that's fair, I guess. I dug this hole for myself.
Anthony, this has been so fun getting to talk to you about Mockbuster.
Yeah, you too.
And The Land That Time Forgot. And now Mockbuster is coming out in select theaters on July 10th. Oh, and it'll be on digital as well. So everybody can watch the insanity of this from the comfort of their own home as they're laughing and spitting beer out of their mouth while they're watching.
Yeah, laughing at my life. That's fine.
Anthony, this has been a joy, and I hope we get to chat again in the future.
Yeah, you too.
And that was Anthony Frith talking Mockbuster. And you can see Mockbuster this Friday, July 10th. When it opens in select theaters, and they will be expanding to more theaters after this Friday. But it will also be available nationwide on digital on Friday. So there's no excuse not to see it. And The Land That Time Forgot, that is available now. I'm not sure on which platform, but that is out now. So it's perfect. Find that streaming. Watch that, watch Mockbuster, and see for yourself how it all works together. But now, as always, head on over to BehindTheLensOnline.net for more reviews and interviews. And there are plenty up there now with more on the way, including a couple of in-depth interviews that are to die for. One with director Daniel Stamm talking his latest film, Lockbox, which just opened. On Friday, starring Carla Gugino. It's a horror film, and it's in theaters now. And then, Tyler Shields. I think I mentioned Tyler on a couple weeks ago. Well, Tyler, writer, director, cinematographer, editor, colorist, and costumer for his glorious neo-noir film, Chapter 51, which was shot on Kodak film, shot in Super 8, 16mm, 35, 65, IMAX, PanaVista, and VistaVision. And the VistaVision was a vintage Alfred Hitchcock camera, no less, that Tyler now owns. The film is in black and white and color, and stars Coleman Domingo. Who doesn't want to see a film with Coleman Domingo? Abigail Breslin, Connor Paolo, and Emily Alin Lind, among others. And also, as an added bonus, in that interview with Tyler, he talks about building an anamorphic lens in order to film Chapter 51. It is a technical mastery. And the interview, it's taking me longer to cull because of everything that we talk about in there. But it'll be up this week, I promise you. So, and then I've got more coming for you people. We've got The Town That Takes. That's another good one that's coming. It's based on the lost settlers of Roanoke, Virginia, back from colonial days. And it's really, it's a good one. I love the lore that's attached to it. So that'll be later. I think that one may be next Monday, but I'll see. Because I've got more interviews this week. Oh my God, I do. But I'm just looking at the calendar for a minute. But that's all the time that we have today. I hope you had a great 4th of July weekend. But I'll be back next week with more insightful and entertaining interviews and movie reviews for you. So until then, I'm Debbie Elias. This is Behind the Lens.